Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Nayman of the group Just Foreign Policy, who talks about the risk of a military confrontation between Iran and the West as the U.S. presidential election campaign moves into high gear. Chris Anders of the ACLU, who explains why his group is urging President Obama to veto legislation that would give the government authority to indefinitely imprison American citizens without charge or trial. And Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat of California, who discusses the Republican drive in the House to exempt arsenic, heavy metals, and industrial mining operations from regulation under the Clean Air Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Sudden gloom and doom has overtaken expectations about China's economy, and global investors are shortening stock shares of major Chinese companies after nearly 30 years of making huge profits from Asia's emerging economic superpower. Meanwhile, workers in central China are rebelling against cost-cutting measures in a new show of militancy. The Hong Kong-based Hang Seng China Enterprise Index, which tracks the value of major Chinese companies, has fallen by 26% so far in 2011. The most intense economic fear is a looming Chinese real estate bubble. Currently, real estate accounts for one-fifth of China's economy, reports the Los Angeles Times. In recent years, cheap credit spurred soaring housing prices, so the average apartment in Shanghai now costs $335,000, or 45 times the average annual salary in the booming city. In central China, the hub of manufacturing, thousands of workers have walked off the job in recent weeks, marking a new rise in worker militancy. Workers want overtime pay owed to them and friendly supervisors reinstated. The China Labor Bulletin noted an October strike protested the firing of 18 supervisors who were dismissed due to sagging sales. One of the fired managers said the company planned to shift production to lower-wage cities inside China. A growing surplus of food crops in Zambia has failed to bring prosperity to farmers in this poor African nation. Instead, the surplus has triggered rock-bottom prices for staple crops like corn, leaving subsistence farmers hungry. Today, more than half the children in Zambia suffer from malnutrition. According to The Nation magazine, this paradox of plenty is not confined to Zambia. Less than half the food crops grown around the globe are consumed by people, with much of it ending up as waste. The legacy of the Green Revolution, employing modern technology to boost agricultural yields, has exacted both social and environmental costs, including depleted water supplies. During 2010, panic swept through Zambia as the price for corn plummeted during the dry summer months. The 600,000-ton surplus left over from 2009 forced local farmers to sell their corn at extremely low prices, relegating many to severe poverty. However, a small number of commercial farmers in Zambia have prospered. These farmers, many of them exiles from Zimbabwe, have succeeded in exporting surplus crops and can afford expensive water irrigation systems to reduce the damage from droughts. These commercial farmers grow half of Zambia's food, although they only account for 4% of farmers in the country. But now, small farmers are banding together to negotiate higher prices for their crops. Similar cooperative organizing models have worked across Africa to boost farmers' incomes and allowed them to gain access to wholesale food markets. Carl Pope, longtime leader of the Sierra Club, has stepped down as chairman of the environmental group amid controversy over declining membership and ties with corporations and major funders. Pope stepped down as executive director in 2010 after 17 years at the helm and accepted the role of chairman. He is credited with saving 10 million acres of wilderness, including the Great Sequoia National Monument. During the Bush years, Pope led the charge to expose Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force, which was suspected of making secret deals with oil companies. Michael Brune of the Rainforest Action Network, who replaced Pope as executive director, brought a renewed focus on direct action and a commitment to revitalize the organization's sagging chapters. Brune also brings a deep skepticism of sponsorship deals with big corporations, such as Sierra Club's endorsement of Clorox products that Pope had pursued. Brune has pledged to boost the Sierra Club's membership to over 1 million and recruit a well-trained army of volunteers, lawyers, and lobbyists. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
A confluence of recent events has dramatically increased tensions between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Western nations. The early November release of an International Atomic Energy Agency report presenting evidence that Iran had been developing a nuclear warhead over the past decade, while also working toward long-range missile capability, provoked calls for more severe economic sanctions. A massive explosion at an Iranian solid fuel missile testing site on November 12th, destroying the facility, has prompted speculation that this blast and another at a uranium conversion facility in Isfahan could have been the result of a U.S. or Israeli covert sabotage operation. The November 29th Iranian student invasion and trashing of the British embassy in Tehran moved relations between the two nations to the breaking point. The embassy incident was followed by reports on December 4th that Iran had shot down a sophisticated U.S. stealth reconnaissance drone over Iranian airspace. In response to these events and the reported earlier assassination of four Iranian nuclear scientists and a computer virus attack on the nation's uranium enrichment program, Iran's Revolutionary Guard announced that they have raised their readiness level to confront potential external airstrikes and covert attacks. While Iran has long maintained that their nuclear research program is for civilian energy production only, both the U.S. and Israel have in the past threatened to launch airstrikes to derail what they believe is a drive to build nuclear weapons. Your reporter spoke with Robert Naiman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy, who assesses the risk of a military confrontation between Iran and the West as the U.S. presidential election campaign moves into high gear.
In analyzing particular events, there's a lot we don't know. You know, there's an explosion in Iran. Why was there an explosion in Iran? Who knows? Could have been an accident. The Iranian government itself is saying it could be the result of an Israeli or U.S. Covert operation. We don't know. Tensions have been increasing. The Senate just passed on a vote of 100-0 last week legislation requiring the president to impose broad sanctions on Iran's central bank. This is a major escalation of the sanctions. Remember that at the beginning of this conflict, there were sanctions on Iran's nuclear program. Now, the Senate, under the leadership of Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois, who introduced this amendment, now the Senate is really pushing for attacking Iran's whole economy. And Senator Kirk has been quite explicit that his goal is to destroy the Iranian economy, make the Iranian people suffer. That's his goal. So this is a major escalation. We've got a Republican presidential campaign going on now, and some of the candidates, particularly the former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, has been very aggressive in his rhetoric about Iran, talking about a military buildup, having a military option with Iran. And this is also happening in context where we, again, as we've seen so many times before, in the run-up to the International Atomic Energy Agency's report, there were again threats from Israel to attack Iran. This is a pattern. It seems every time the issue of Iran's nuclear program is on the international table, then there are these threats that Israel will attack Iran. And it seems clear that, and in fact this is often openly stated, that the Israeli government's goal is to pressure Europe in particular to agree to whatever sanctions are being proposed. And so the Europeans, in a way, that are being threatened, not Iran, by Israel's military threat, because, of course, there would be significant economic and political collateral damage for Europe in particular, also the United States, as the Obama administration said, if the Israeli government were to attack Iran militarily. Iran could respond by closing the Straits of Hormuz, for example, through which the majority of the world's oil passes. This would be a huge disruption in the world economy at a time when, you know, already the world economy is quite fragile. So, yes, there is an escalation going on, not just in the present, but with some indications about possibilities in the future. You know, imagine if Mitt Romney becomes the president of the United States in January 2013. We see a war with Iran. We'd be more likely to see a war with Iran then. Many of Romney's advisors are people who served early in the Bush administration and were cheerleaders for war with Iraq. So, yeah, there are a lot of troubling signs with respect to the potential for military conflict with Iran.
Are there actors within the Obama administration that will do their best to avoid a military conflict with Iran going into this very dangerous year of saber-rattling around the U.S. presidential election? Or do you think the country could find itself in a new conflict in Iran in the next 12 months?
Well, I think both those things are true. I think that the administration does not want war with Iran and is not trying to push the U.S. towards war with Iran, and instead is trying to pursue this policy of sanctions and, you know, possibly covert action on Iran's program. However, those policies are dangerous in the sense that the more you escalate the sanctions from, you know, narrow sanctions to broad sanctions that are really attacking the economy, and the more you do things, I mean, you know, who's exactly doing this, but whether it's the Israeli government, the U.S. government, but things like assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, the more things you do like that, the more you run the risk of an Iranian retaliation, which then might provoke U.S. or Israeli retaliation, and so on and so forth. So the things could escalate out of control, even if it's not the goal, which I don't think it is, the goal of the Obama administration to have a war with Iran, but it is the goal of the Obama administration to dramatically increase pressure on Iran, possibly with the goal of regime change.
Robert, along with conservative politicians in this country that want to use foreign policy issues as a cudgel to beat up Barack Obama in advance of the November 2012 election, there is some thought that the Iranian hardliners benefit in some way from confrontation and even airstrikes or attacks on the country, in that the nation is quite divided in terms of a lot of opposition to the mullahs and the fundamentalist government there, and that an attack on the country would stoke nationalism and distract people from any kind of internal dissension going on.
Well, I think there's no question that escalation in the external confrontation benefits hardliners in Iran and benefits the government at the expense of civil society and democratic space. And this trend is well known. I think it's not an accident, and many people think it's not a total coincidence, that the protest movement in Iran in 2009 happened in a context where there had been a de-escalation. So the beginning of the Obama administration, Obama came in talking about diplomacy with Iran, made some positive gestures. People in Iran stopped believing that the U.S. was going to attack, or the attack on the U.S. was imminent. That increased political space because it decreased the ability of the government there to rally people against the threat from the United States. Just the escalation of the climate of confrontation constricts the political space in Iran.
That was Robert Naiman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy. Find more analysis and commentary about the rising tensions with Iran on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It's been a little over 10 years since the 9/11 attacks on the U.S., but new legislation now making its way through Congress has the imprint of similar bills that were hastily passed and signed into law in the fearful days following the nation's most deadly terrorist assault. The House and Senate have recently voted to include a provision in the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act that mandates that all accused terrorists be indefinitely imprisoned in military rather than in the civilian court system. But most alarmingly, the measure also empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens suspected of engaging in terrorism without charge or trial. Although many civil libertarians have been critical of President Obama for not thoroughly repudiating many of the Bush administration's harsh extra-constitutional methods of dealing with terrorism suspects, the White House, along with the Secretary of Defense, the directors of the FBI, CIA, and National Intelligence, have all publicly come out in opposition to the indefinite detention provision, saying that they are both harmful and counterproductive. But some observers believe the Obama administration's objections have more to do with preserving executive branch power rather than opposition to the substance of the legislation. Your reporter spoke with Chris Anders, senior legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, who explains why his group is opposed to the indefinite detention legislation and are urging President Obama to veto the measure.
This is an amazing bill, and unfortunately a bill that's on a very fast track, going back to both houses of Congress and being sent to the president's desk. Here's what's in it. There are a couple of provisions in it, in the bill, that allow for the indefinite detention without charge or trial of people picked up far from any battlefield. And this would be the military being the ones who would be imprisoning people. And it's so extensive and so broadly written that it even applies to people picked up within the United States and even applies to United States citizens. And so the result of this could be, and it could very well be, that within the next few weeks, this president, any future president, could have the power to order the military to indefinitely detain, imprison American citizens and others picked up here in the United States, picked up in friendly countries like Canada, Great Britain, elsewhere, put them in military prisons without any charge or trial based on suspicion alone. And so it's basically anyone that would be suspected of having any kind of relationship with a terrorist would be able to be put into military detention without charge or trial.
We have seen President Obama take onto himself extraordinary powers, where he's ordered the assassination of a terrorist suspect in Yemen, al-Awlaki, just over the last month or two. And there have been other targeted assassinations abroad. How does President Obama's current power, which he accords himself, relate to this legislation? I would imagine it strengthens his hand to do exactly what he's been doing all along and that George Bush before him did. But it's interesting that his administration is opposing this legislation.
Yeah, well, one of the things that the Obama administration has said repeatedly throughout this year is that they believe that they have all the detention authority that they need. And certainly they've claimed a lot of detention authority, a lot of authority to do a lot of things around the world that a lot of people, and certainly we at the ACLU, believe that they should not be doing. The difference here is two things. And one is that this broadens out who can be detained and implicitly also broadens out who it is that we're at war with. And it delinks the war authority from 9/11. So this is no longer about going after the people that committed that horrible attack on the United States. This is about going after terrorism suspects and people who support terrorism suspects and people who allegedly support terrorism suspects anywhere in the world, including within the United States. And that's a big difference.
Tell us a little bit about the motivation. Why is this happening now? It seems to have a lot to do with election year politics and posturing, especially, you know, among legislators who are up for election in 2012.
Well, that's a million-dollar question. Why now? I mean, certainly it's more than 10 years since 9/11. The United States is pulling out of Iraq by the end of this year. Combat troops will be out in Afghanistan. The government is trying to figure out, Obama administration is trying to figure out how to get out of Afghanistan, I think probably right now as quickly as they can. And Osama bin Laden, of course, is dead. So why now? I think that really it's a couple different things. And one is it's the Republican takeover of the House gave this a little impetus to get this passed on the House. They finally felt like they had the votes to do it there. But then you also have a couple members of Congress, particularly senators, who have two different worldviews. One is there are people that just view this as a good partisan issue, and they just want to try to embarrass President Obama or embarrass other people and try to say, well, you're not tough on terrorists if you aren't willing to lock up even American citizens. But then there's another group of people, including people like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, who have this view that the United States is at war everywhere, and that the war on terrorism is not like war on poverty, where it's some kind of metaphor, that it really is a war, and it's a war everywhere and against everyone. And if you have that worldview, it kind of makes sense. Well, maybe we should start using the military in the United States. Maybe we should start using the military against American citizens. And certainly, why don't we start locking people up before they do something? But that, of course, is not the way the United States operates. It's not the way our Constitution operates. It's not the way we as a people like to view ourselves. And so it's a very dangerous worldview. And this bill is a real fight for, I think, really the very soul of who we are as a people and who we are as a country.
That was Chris Anders, Senior Legislative Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. Find links to more information and articles on terrorism, the Constitution, and the rule of law on our website at btlonline.org. California Representative Henry Waxman has served in the House for 36 years and says he's never seen such assaults on public health and the environment as are happening this year in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. Waxman, who chaired the House Energy and Commerce Committee from 2007 until 2011, is now the ranking Democrat on the panel. He says that this year alone, Republicans have introduced 170 bills to weaken environmental laws, especially the Clean Air Act. The latest is Bill H.R. 1633 that Waxman says purports to be about regulating dust on farms but actually exempts major industrial polluters from the Clean Air Act. According to Waxman and other critics, the measure allows open-pit mines, smelters, cement plants, coal processing plants, and other industries to emit unlimited amounts of particulate pollution, which include arsenic, lead, cadmium, zinc, and mercury, among other toxic substances. During committee debate on the measure, Democratic members offered amendments to preserve the Environmental Protection Agency's role in regulating industrial pollution containing arsenic and other heavy metals, and the EPA's authority to control air pollution from open-pit mines. Both amendments were defeated by the GOP majority. The bill comes up for a vote before the full House during the second week of December. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Representative Waxman, who says that while he expects the legislation to pass in the House, he hopes the bill will be stopped in the Senate or by a presidential veto.
The Republican-controlled House has been the most anti-environmental in the history of our country. They have voted 170 times this year to weaken our environmental laws, and the Clean Air Act has been the target of the most attacks, with 61 votes to dismantle the act. This has continued the efforts to block actions to address climate change, to stop actions to prevent air and water pollution, to undermine protections for public lands and coastal areas, and to weaken the protection of the environment in dozens of other ways. This week in the House of Representatives, we're going to vote on a bill that's very popular because it's going to prevent the regulation of farm dust. And people who come from the agricultural areas say their farmers are scared to death that EPA is going to regulate the farm dust, which is so natural. People walk around or have horses or whatever they do on the farms. The only issue is, however, that EPA has insisted they have no interest in regulating farm dust. And that doesn't make any difference to the Republicans. They want to pass a law to prevent it. But the real underlying reason they want to pass this law is because they're also going to remove regulations from the pollution containing arsenic and other heavy metals, and to stop EPA's authority to control air pollution from open-pit mines. They don't talk about that, but what they are really going to do is to allow toxic pollutants are pollutants that cause cancer and birth defects and other neurological problems, and they're going to stop regulation of these dangerous pollutants from mines, smelters, cement plants, and coal processing plants. So this isn't just stopping EPA from regulating farm dust, where they don't even regulate farm dust and they don't intend to regulate farm dust. It's really not about farms. It's about letting industrial polluters off the hook for cleaning up their pollution.
So the vote is coming up this week. Is it a foregone conclusion how it's going to go?
So far, every vote that's been on the House floor, the Republican majority has prevailed in passing the most extreme anti-environmental position. They even took a bill that came out of our committee and made it worse on the House floor. They struck the goal of having standards for air quality that would achieve health outcomes. And they struck that from the requirement of the Clean Air Act, which has been the essential part of the law since 1970. And this is just like so many of these others. They've passed the House, where the Republicans control the majority. So far, the Senate has not acted, and hopefully they won't take these proposals up. But nevertheless, Republicans have them ready to go if they can trade them away for something in the Senate and force the president to sign very, very bad environmental laws. But I hope they won't get away with it.
How can they force the president to sign a bad environmental law? He can veto.
Well, the president can veto, but we have bills that are must-pass bills. For example, before we leave this year, we have to pass a bill to fund the government for the next fiscal year. The president, of course, has insisted that we continue a tax break for Americans on the payroll tax, and Republicans say they want to do that. Democrats say they want to do that. There's a problem on getting the way to pay for that tax break, to continue it, and the Republicans are looking to see what they'll find acceptable. They don't want to raise anybody's taxes, particularly for the upper income. But in the whole mix of things that have to be done, they can slip in some anti-environmental provisions and see if they could get the president to swallow them, because that may be the only way we keep the government going. I don't think they're going to get away with it. I think the president's going to stand firm, but we've got to make sure that he does and make sure that the Senate insists that these kind of riders on the bills be dropped.
Henry Waxman, how long have you been serving in Congress?
I've been in the House for 36 years, and I've never seen anything like we're seeing this year, where there's no restraint on the Republicans' ability and desire to wreck our environmental laws that were set up to protect the public health. If we let arsenic and lead and other toxic pollutants go right to the public without using control technology that we already have available to us, we will be sentencing people to very serious health disasters, not just kids who have asthma, which is bad enough, but inducing diseases like cancer and other respiratory problems.
That was Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat of California. For more information on congressional debate over the deregulation of industrial polluters, visit our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.